With you. Did anyone wake up an hour early this morning? There's a few yeses out there. It's a bit easier these days with the phones. It kind of does it all for you, doesn't it? But gee, it is a bit of a rip-off when you wake up an hour early. You never get that hour sleep back. It's just gone forever. This week, guys, we're going to look at Mark chapter 7. And It's the kind of chapter where if you concentrate well and hear what Jesus is really saying, it's pretty devastating. Because I'd say Jesus deals a devastating diagnosis about the real problem with people in this chapter. It's hard to hear and hard to accept. But here's the thing. If we never see with clarity what the real issue is with people and with ourselves, then we'll never really celebrate the solution that Jesus brings properly. Last weekend with Easter, you know, I saw kind of two dynamics happening. At least what I saw anyway. I saw people, it was such a great weekend, so many people gathering. And I saw so many Christians really celebrating in the core of their spirits the salvation that Jesus brings through the cross and the resurrection, and saw so much of that going on. You know, we also see, though, a broader crowd of people with us who have some kind of connection with Jesus and church and coming along because it's Easter. And yet for them, many of them, there's not necessarily a real heart celebration. There's just a connection. And so they're here in church with us. And maybe that's even you here this morning. You've come back this week again to be with us. It's great to have you with us. But maybe you're one of those. And you kind of look at these other Christians around you and you see them with a real kind of deep joy or rejoicing in about this cross, which you feel like you kind of get, but you don't really get. Chapter 7's going to help us today to see what the real problem is, because if we can see what the real problem is, then we've got an opportunity to possibly get the real solution and really celebrate Jesus like we should and rejoice in him. I've been a father now for 14 years. I know I don't look that old. that's because I'm not. I was married very young. I think we were 12 when we were married. But I have to say, I do love my life with kids. I do. I love it. However, you know, there are things that I miss about my past life, you know, my life before the kids came. And sometimes those things that I miss, some of those things are just simple things. They're just little things, really, like this. I miss just being able to come home, plonk myself on the couch and just watch the news. You know, it's funny, isn't it? It's just a little thing. You can catch up on the news other times of the day, but I just miss being able to sit down in the lounge, just watch the news in the evening. Because, of course, with young kids, you just can't do it at that time of night. Things are hectic, you know. It's dinner. In our house, it's jobs, and then it's reading, and then it's shower, and then it's bed, and that whole process stretches out for a good couple of hours because they're all different ages, and it's just, you can't just plonk yourself on the couch and watch the news. It's just going to go even worse in the home. But anyway, the other night, after dinner, something really strange happened. All the kids just kind of went, we've got millions of kids, right? So they all just went off doing all their chores and jobs happily, quietly. And Deb and I kind of look at each other like, what's happening here? It was like really strange. And then we look at each other like, what do we do now? And I'm like, let's hide from the kids, you know? Let's try and hide. And I said, I know. Let's watch the news. Isn't it funny? What, it's just so radical, you know, so crazy. Let's just watch the news. Sneak off into the spare room, watch the news together. And Deb said to me, nah, it'll just be bad news, bad news, bad news, bad news with a feel-good, fluffy animal story at the end. And I say, oh, come on, don't be so pessimistic. Let's watch the news, you know. So we went and watched the news, so rebellious and crazy. And sure enough, my wife was very, very right, as she is. Right? Article 1, terror bombing in Brussels airport. Article 2, a woman abducted in the outback, feared murdered. Article 3, stabbing murders in Sydney. Article 4, drive-by shooting in Melbourne. Article 5, a tragic car accident where everyone dies except the driver who was drunk. Article 6, the fluffy feel-good story. A cheetah had some baby cubs in the zoo. It's like, I know the news, they have a format and they kind of follow it, but Is that meant to comfort us, you know? I think it is. It's meant to kind of help you, stop you from dwelling on how much of an issue the human race has, how much of a big problem it was. But really, dwelling on the fact that a cheetah had some cubs, it doesn't do it for me, you know. It doesn't relieve the pain if you're actually really focusing in. If you think about it for long enough, you know, now obviously the news follows a format, but apparently there's no shortage of bad news stories day after day. And if you think about that, you find yourself thinking, what is wrong with our world? Like, the people in this world clearly have some serious issues. And then sometimes you have a bit of a deeper reflection than that. Instead of it's just people out there have some serious issues, sometimes it kind of comes close to home and you see that the people with serious issues are actually really close to you. In fact, you might know one of those stories, the stabbing murders in Sydney. The fellow was murdered. He's a local guy. And he's, you know, his son goes to Terrigal High. And actually, he used to come here a few years back. Some of you know him or knew him. Sometimes the stories come really close to home. I remember a month or so ago when those teenage kids, local kids, beat up the Asian shop owner at the corner down here. And we're thinking, wow, like these kind of horrific things are happening in our hometown. There's that kind of level of violence and racism going on in our kids, in our area. Sometimes the evil just comes close. And sometimes it comes even closer. You see it in your own friendship networks. You know, you've had this friendship network that got blown up because someone slept with someone else's wife. And many of you know how that just shatters whole friendship networks. Or maybe you see it in your own family, in your own extended family. There's pain now and there's hurt and betrayal because there's been selfishness and things have happened over the years. Sometimes we see that even the people around me, very close to me, have very real issues. And then there's another whole level of reflection, isn't there? The third level, the deepest level, which is actually where you look at yourself and you see things in your own life and you think, whoa, I've got issues. You ever shock yourself with your own wickedness? You ever find yourself doing something or thinking something and you're just thinking, where did that come from? You know, little old mild-mannered you just kind of snaps. We've all got different versions of snapping. Some of us snap quietly so no one else sees it, but inside you're just seething with anger. And it's even surprising to you. You're like, where did that come from? Oh, so churned up in here. You know? Or you know, you're in your car and someone does something in the traffic and just outflows all this foul language out of your mouth and you shock yourself with what's come out of your mouth. And no one else can hear it. You're just thinking, what was that? Where'd that come from? Or there's just an explosion of anger or violence, you know, that comes from you. I always remember Jody Dagan reflecting. Jody and Ben Dagan were here with us at Erina before we started Peninsula and they moved down there. And Jody, I always remember what Jody said as she reflected on what she thought about herself before and after kids. She said, I thought I was a nice person until I had kids. And then I realised I'm nowhere near as nice as I thought I was. I'm nowhere near as patient as I thought I was. I'm nowhere near as selfless as I thought I was. I'm nowhere near as kind as I thought I was. She's kind of, and I've heard people say that. I thought I was a nice person before I got married, before I had kids, before life happened to me. And then all of a sudden you just see behavior and thinking that comes out that you even shock yourself. Do you ever have that kind of level of deep reflection where you just start breaking bad and it's shocking to yourself? We do tend to underestimate our own potential for doing horrendous things. We like to think well of ourselves, and sometimes we can shock ourselves. Now, when you have that kind of reflection about the world, about the people close by to you, and even about yourself, when you have that kind of reflection, you will find yourself thinking, what is wrong with us anyway? What was wrong with me anyway? What is the deal here? Now, you open up the Bible and you ask Jesus, what is the deal with us anyway? What's the problem here? And what he says to us here is this: you misdiagnose the problem most of the time. And that's why your solutions don't work and you don't make the world any better and you don't become any better. It's because Jesus would say the problem is far deeper than you might think. It's far more serious than you might expect. Jesus diagnoses the problem with people in a very unflattering way for us, in a way that is very confronting to us, it's sobering to us. We would prefer not to hear it or face it or accept it. However, if we don't hear the way Jesus diagnoses the problem, then we won't ever see what it is and we won't ever get the real solution for it. So we must, and let's do it again today, Mark chapter 7. Come there with me. Jesus speaks about the real problem with people here, but he does it in a context that we're going to need to dig into a little bit. And many of you understand the context full well, and that's great. Others of you will be very new to this, so see if you can catch the context of the first century and what's happening for Jesus here. Pick it up there with me in verse 1, chapter 7. The Pharisees and some of the teachers of the law who had come from Jerusalem gathered around Jesus. Now, this is a mob of Jewish leaders who we've seen them previously in Mark chapter 3. They keep following Jesus around and pressing in on him to question him, to try to catch him out. And they've come for him again, and this time with another kind of accusation or question. Verse 2, and they saw some of his disciples eating food with hands that were defiled, that is, unwashed. The good thing about Mark's gospel is he's obviously writing to, you know, a non-Jewish audience. And so he includes these little explanations or comments along the way so we understand the Jewish traditions. And so he says there, look in the brackets, verse 3, the Pharisees and all the Jews do not eat unless they give their hands a ceremonial washing, holding to the traditions of the elders. So their problem with Jesus' disciples saying that their hands are unwashed is not just a physically unwashed, it's not a hygiene problem really, it's that they're not doing the ceremonial washing, which is like a religious washing that the tradition of the elders said all Jews needed to do before they ate, particularly if you'd been out in the marketplace where you'd been mixing with unclean people and touching unclean things. You needed to ceremonially wash your hands, and it was quite a procedure to do it, to become, you know, religiously acceptable before God. And so verse 5 there, the Pharisees and the teachers of the law asked Jesus, why don't your disciples live according to the traditions of the elders instead of eating their food with defiled hands? Now, where do these traditions of the elders come from anyway? Let's look a little bit of background here. The traditions of the elders are exactly that. They're things that the elders, the leaders of God's people over time, had developed as traditions. Not technically the laws and commands of God, but they're traditions that have been added to the law. God did give his people extensive commands and laws. God gave his people in history through Moses the laws that we see throughout, recorded for us in Exodus and Leviticus, summarized in the Ten Commandments. And there's a whole heap of laws there. And a lot of them are about what it means to be ceremonially clean and ceremonially unclean and defiled before God. But we need to catch why God originally gives the laws and commands to his people. Because there's lots of them, and they can seem a little bizarre to us when we look back from a different context. There's all these really crazy laws. But at the heart of the intent of the law is this. It was to help God's people understand that they were to be different. They were to be set apart from the other nations. They were to be holy to God. And so they were to follow these laws, and in following those laws, have their hearts directed to honour and love God. That was the intent of the commands, to draw his people's hearts to himself. That's why God gives the laws. And when they see that they can't keep the commands, they actually repent of their sin and they're drawn to appreciate a God who forgives. One of the laws that was given by God to his people was a law in regards to ceremonial washing of hands. But it wasn't given for everyone of the Jews to follow. It was given just for one group, the priests. And if you're a priest working in the temple, you needed to obey this command of ceremonial washing of hands. However, what happened over time is the Jews has extended that command or expanded the command so that it went beyond just the priests needing to keep it. Now all the Jews needed to keep this command, although they did acknowledge it wasn't a command, it was a tradition of the elders, but they held to it very highly. And what happened over time actually is there were many, many of these things happen. Where the elders and the leaders of God's people were so concerned not to break the commands of God that they added to the commands of God these other traditions, and they were added for good motive. God gives them commands. They hear the commands. They say, that's great. We don't want to break those commands, so we want to stay way back. We don't want to go anywhere near breaking the commands, so let's add another layer. Let's call them the traditions, so that they will keep us further back from breaking those commands. So you can see it was these traditions were created in the beginning with a very good motive, so that we wouldn't even get close to breaking the commands. I picture it like this. God gives his commands to his people, and it's like he plants these trees in a garden. I picture it like this. He plonks those trees in. He says, they're the commands. They're the laws. You know, don't eat from these trees. That might remind you of something. Don't eat from these trees. And then God's people go, okay, good. Well, how can we make sure we don't? Let's plant a hedge around this garden so we can't even get to the commands to break them, you know, because we want to take it seriously. So they plant this hedge, and it's done for good motive, so that they would stay way back from breaking the commands of God, and so that they would honour God with their hearts. But what happens over time is the hedge grows up. Yeah? And so over time, they come more and more focused on the hedge, and particularly as the hedge gets bigger in their minds and in their hearts, all they see is the hedge. And so all they see is the traditions of man, and they end up forgetting the original commands, or particularly forgetting the intent of the original commands, which was to honour God with their hearts. And they're just all caught up in human tradition, which ends up causing them to be first and foremost concerned about acceptability with each other, in each other's eyes, and forgetting to actually have their hearts honouring God and obeying him. This is what's happened for the Jewish nation over time. And so as they come to Jesus with one of their traditions that he's not holding, and they say, why are you and your disciples not following this tradition? Jesus sees what's happening for them, and he comes back at them with strength. Have a look at verse 6, what Jesus actually says to them. He replied, Isaiah was right when he prophesied about you hypocrites. It's like, bam. He's like, you having a go at me? You guys are hypocrites. You're calling me to follow your traditions, but do you know what you're doing? You know, you're just actors. You just got a mask on. You're not the real deal at all. You're forgetting the whole point of this. And he quotes for them from the prophet Isaiah, these people honour me with their lips, but their hearts are far from me. You see, the issue is the heart. They worship me in vain. Their teachings are merely human rules. Now, for the Pharisees and their leaders to receive this word from Isaiah being directed at them would have been very offensive. They would have known well this prophecy from Isaiah. They would have known well the context that it was given, you know, as a word of judgment against God's people in the past because of God's people's wickedness. And Jesus is basically saying, this is for you. You're that wicked. You're that hypocritical. And he levels it straight at them. He says, verse 8, you've let go of the commands of God and are holding on to true human traditions. You're so focused on the hedge, you forgot about the commands. You're letting go of the commands of God, and particularly the intent of the command of God, which is to honour God with your heart and love him from your inner places. That was the whole point. And Jesus is saying, you've lost it. And to help kind of drill home the point, Jesus gives them an example of another command that they've let go of in order to keep following their own human traditions. Verses 9 through to 13. And he continued, you have a fine way of setting aside the commands of God in order to observe your own traditions. For Moses said, honour your father and mother, and anyone who curses their father or mother is to be put to death. So he says, consider this command. You remember this one? You should, because this is a command that God gave. You know, we get in the Ten Commandments. Honour your father and mother. It's a serious one. If you curse them, you're to be put to death. This is serious. You're to follow this command. Honour your father and mother. But I want to show you how you are actually neglecting this command for the sake of your traditions. Now, just the first thing to catch is this. To honour your father and mother in the ancient world meant, at least, that as you grew up as a young person, you would obey them. And then when you became of age, working age, you would actually work to provide financially for your aging parents. That's how things worked in the ancient world. Parents became dependent on their children. It's the other way around, isn't it? It's craziness. These days, we've flipped it a bit. I mean, maybe we still try and do that. But in the ancient world, people had kids, and as many kids as you could, So there was more chance they'd be able to look after you in your aging years. And you became very dependent on your children financially. That's just the way the ancient world worked. And so part of obeying the command to honour your father and mother would be to provide for them when they were older. And Jesus says, let me show you how you are neglecting the command to honour your father and mother, and you're neglecting your responsibility to provide for them in order to keep your human tradition. Verse 11, but you say that if anyone declares that what might have been used to help their father or mother is Corban, and the commentary there is that is devoted to God. So here's a human tradition developed by the Jews that they would see a particular income stream that a person might have or some possession that they might have and encourage people to declare that Corban, meaning I devote these things to God, to the temple. And so they can't be used for anything else. They can't be used for helping family or anything else. And the leaders were encouraging people to declare certain things and a lot of their income, Corban, which sounds good to devote things to the temple, but what in effect it was doing was disabling people from being able to care for their parents, as he says in verse 12. Then you no longer let them do anything for their father or mother, thus you nullify the word of God by your own traditions that you have handed down. So Jesus says, look, here's one example about how your human traditions that you're calling Jewish people to keep are actually inhibiting them from keeping the command of God. Can you see what you're doing? And then Jesus says, and you do many things like that. I could give you lots more examples. You do it everywhere and anywhere. You're so caught up in the traditions that you've added to the law, that's all you can see. And you're forgetting the real thing. You've lost the real thing, which is obeying my commands and leading God's people to obey my commands and have their hearts honour him. Now, step back from this a little bit. You might be thinking, that context is so different from ours today. It's so strange from ours today. How does that apply to us today? It is different, but what I want to notice is the very same dynamic that was going on in the ancient world, the way people thought about life and the problem with humanity exists today. We've got the very same idea present today. So catch this. Here in the ancient world, you've got people acknowledging there's a problem. There's a problem with the people around them. There's a problem with them. But the way they define the problem means that they end up thinking the problem is out there. And so you've got to keep the bad things away from you. You've got to stay separate from them. And if they do acknowledge that they've got some kind of uncleanliness or whatever, the way you deal with it is to tweak your behaviour with religious observances to kind of cleanse yourself. And so they're thinking it's just a surface level problem if I've got it, and it can be changed. So really the way they're thinking is the problem's out there, keep your distance from it. And if there is any level of problem with me, it's just surface level and it can be easily dealt with through, you know, certain religious observances. Is that not the same way that people think today and that we're tempted to think today? The problem's out there, so I've got to make sure I don't get too influenced by the environment that I live in, and I need to be very careful of what I get exposed to. Now, there is some truth in that, but that's not the full picture. Or people today say, you know, they might acknowledge something, that a level of flaw in them, but usually we just say, look, I've just learned a bad habit here, so I just need to break it and then I'll be fine. It's just a surface level problem. But Jesus goes deep to the core of the issue and basically says, no, that's not it. It's not simply out there, and it's not simply a surface level issue. You've got to hear this. You've got to understand this. Look at verse 14. That's what he says. Again, Jesus called the crowd to him and said, listen to me, everyone, and understand this. Got to catch this. Nothing outside a person can defile them by going into them. Rather, it is what comes out of a person that defiles them. Now, the primary context here is unclean food coming from outside a person into them and defile them. And Jesus is saying, the principle here really is saying, look, that's not what corrupts a person. You don't get corrupted when something bad outside of you comes into you and corrupts you. You get corrupted when something inside of you comes out. And how does that work? It's because when it comes out of you, it displays that the problem's already in you. Yeah? Jesus goes deep here and he's basically saying the problem is not out there. The big issue is not out there in the externals. The big issue is right here already in the internals. And here's what's devastating. Look at verse 17. After he had left the crowd and entered the house, his disciples asked him about the parable. So they're still a little bit confused. They don't get it. Verse 18, are you so dull? He asks. Don't you see that nothing that enters a person from outside of them can defile them? You don't get defiled, corrupted. You don't become evil and unacceptable to God because something outside of you has come into you. And Jesus explains why that is the case in verse 19. He says, because it does not go into their heart. And speaking specifically about unclean food, it just goes into your stomach and then out of your body again. It doesn't go into your heart. And by zooming in on the heart, Jesus is putting his finger on the place of genuine corruption. You know, the place you need to be most concerned about being defiled is in your heart. And Jesus says, that's what God's concerned about. That's his primary concern. It's actually all about the heart. And he's got some devastating news for us about our own hearts. The key is the heart. And when the Bible talks about the heart, many of you know this already, it's not just talking about that physical muscle in your body. When the Bible talks about the heart, it's talking about the center of your personhood. The heart is the core of your being. Your heart is where your desires come from. It's where your beliefs come from. Your heart is where your thinking comes from, the thoughts of your heart. Your heart is who you really are. You live from your heart. And when the heart is defiled, corrupted, and wicked, the whole person is defiled, corrupted, and wicked. And Jesus says, you know where the problem originates? In your heart. The issue is already in there already. Look at verse 20. He went on. What comes out of a person is what defiles them. He keeps saying this. It's not what goes into you that defiles you. It's what comes out of you, because what comes out of you displays what's already in there. A defiled heart. Verse 21. For it is from within, out of a person's heart, that evil thoughts come. When you find yourself behaving in a way that's shocking to yourself, the first inclination you'll have is to blame external factors, the situation, the circumstance, the people around you, what's been done to you. And Jesus says, no, 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 no. The reason why evil behavior exists in your life, the reason why you do things that even shock you, originates from within you. Evil behaviors come from evil thoughts in the heart. Verse 21, for it is from within, out of a person's heart, that evil thoughts come. Sexual immorality. When you notice sexual immorality in all its different forms in your life, just know this, it has come from sexually impure thoughts from your own heart. Theft. When you steal things, big or small, just know that where that has come from is a greed and an envy that's already there in your heart. Murder. When we see murder, just know that murder comes from anger and hatred that's already there in the heart. Adultery, greed, malice, deceit, lewdness, envy, slander. When you catch yourself slandering a person to their face, behind their back, when no one's watching, or just slandering them in your heart, maybe the words don't even come out, and you think, wow, where did that come from? Came from your heart. It's actually out of the overflow of the heart that the mouth speaks. That's hard to hear. Verse 23, all these evils come from inside and defile a person. When I'm at my worst, my temptation is to think, well, that's not really me. You know, I'm just being impacted by this situation or this person. You know, the real me is the nice me. Jesus says, no, no, when you're at your worst, that's actually the real you coming out. I don't blame anyone else or anything else. But we would far prefer to think that we are essentially good, and this is what we get told because we believe Confucianism, we are essentially good, sometimes making bad choices. And Jesus says, no, it's the other way around. We are essentially wicked, essentially evil, with the capacity to sometimes do good things. It appears that we have a far greater issue than any of us would like to admit. Now, sure, you may have been exposed to evil things that influence your behaviour, for sure. Absolutely, I don't want to deny that. You may have had evil things done to you that have impacted you greatly. And I don't want to deny that. That's true. But Jesus says the real issue is you. The real problem is your own wicked heart. Deep in the core of your being is a fatal flaw, a sinful, wicked, evil heart. And that's the problem. If you refuse to hear this, and if you refuse to accept this, you'll never get the solution. You'll dabble with surface-level solutions. You'll externalize until the end, saying that the problem is out there, and you'll miss out on getting the solution that Jesus offers. But if you can see what Jesus is saying and hear it and accept it, if you can see that the problem is you, then you'll see how the solution can't be just you. Yeah? You'll see that you need a solution outside of yourself, and you'll go hunting for that solution, that merciful Saviour that would come to you. Now, that's quite heavy, so let me just give you a quick break, talk about something else for a minute. Some of you know me pretty well, and I don't think I've got a very complicated life. I think pretty simple life, pretty simple man, really. I've got Jesus in his church and in my life, and I've got this family that I'm responsible for, that I'm appreciative. And there's just a couple of hobbies in my life, not too many, just a couple. Coffee, the odd surf, and one that you may not know. I really love grass. Now, that probably needs to be clarified, doesn't it? You know what I mean, though. I love a good green lawn, and I work hard at home on my lawn. It's just what I'm like. Not because, not so that the kids have got something nice to play on. I don't care about that. I just want to get it good so that I can just sit and look at it. And just get down there and walk on it in my bare feet. I mean, call me a weirdo, but like, it just does something soothing and comforting to my spirit looking at my lawn. And some of you know exactly what I'm talking about, don't you? You got that connection going on with your lawn as well. It's almost spiritual, isn't it? So you can imagine my devastation when recently, quite suddenly, my lawn started to go brown and die. And despite all my best efforts from all my vast knowledge of lawn care over the years, to water the lawn and fertilise the lawn and topsoil the lawn, it just kept dying. And my efforts weren't working. It kept dying because I wasn't addressing the real issue. I was just teetering with surface level issues. You see, the real problem was deep down in the root system. The real problem was not on the surface at all. My real problem was an infestation of those dirty little army worms. You know, some of you guys got that too, haven't you? They live deep, you know, in the grass, in the soil, and they eat the grass from the roots up. So they basically kill your lawn from deep in the lawn, and it's like they kill it from the inside out. It's just so devastating, yeah? Kill it from the inside out. And as long as I kept dealing with things on the surface, it just wasn't going to do any good. But the minute I got to make the correct diagnosis, you know where I'm going with this, don't you? The minute I got to make the correct diagnosis and see the problem was deep down, then I could come up with workable solutions. You know, most people say just, you know, pesticides, pop it on the lawn, you'll kill those worms, which kind of works. You know, you kill off the worms, but many of them will turn into moths before you get to them, and they lay eggs, and those eggs lie dormant until next year, so it comes back again. You never really get rid of it. You just put it off for a little bit. So you know the only way to really get rid of armyworm? Get the bobcat out and dig up your whole lawn and all the soil and chuck it and just lay some more soil and new lawn, and then that's how you solve the problem. Now, I'm so tempted to do that, you know. I'm not going to do that. I just can't bring myself to do it. But that's how you actually, it's the drastic action that really solves a deep down problem. Now, you know where I'm going with this, don't you? A lawn is one thing, and if you don't diagnose the problem, you don't actually fix it. But the stakes are a lot higher, aren't they, with a human life. And if we don't diagnose the problem right, then we'll just keep dabbling with surface-level solutions which actually don't do anything in the end. We need to get to the... We need to see the real problem. We need to diagnose it properly. Jesus tells us what it is. He says the real problem is not just out there. The real problem is not just surface level. The real problem is deep down in the heart. And so the only real solution is a solution that gets to the heart of a person. But what can a person do about their own heart? I guess you could try to coach your heart and train your heart or just contain the evil of your heart. You could try that, but that won't ever fix your heart. Our only real hope has got to come from outside of ourselves. And that's where Jesus says, that's me. That's why I've come. I am the one who can actually fix your problem. And Jesus comes with the only real solution for a corrupted, defiled, wicked, evil heart. And he comes to us with a solution that's so wonderful, but you'll never catch how wonderful it is until you see the real problem. The solution, you could say, comes on two levels. It's almost like Jesus comes and brings us a double cure for our problem, and we sing about that double cure, don't we? Jesus comes for us with two things, forgiveness and transformation. So wonderful. Forgiveness and transformation. Let's look at the first one, forgiveness. If you've been able to see the true condition of your own heart and you've grieved that in any way, then you will, with me, when you hear that forgiveness is available, you'll jump out of your skin. When you hear that forgiveness from God is available through Jesus, you'll go for that because you know that is what you desperately need. And here's the good news of Jesus. He comes to bring forgiveness. There's forgiveness available through Jesus. And it's available because he is the one who has come and lived the perfect life without a defiled heart on our behalf. And then he goes willingly to the cross and he takes on himself the punishment that we deserve for having evil, corrupted, defiled hearts. He takes that on himself, dies with it, deals with it, rises again after the third day and turns to a broken, defiled humanity with the offer of forgiveness. And says, you come, you put your trust, your belief, your faith in what I've just done for you on the cross, and you can be forgiven. And some of you know that forgiveness all too well. You've come and put your trust in Jesus, and you've heard that declaration of God on you, forgiven. How wonderful is that? Forgiveness, slate wiped clean, sin chucked as far as the east is from the west and remembered no more. Redemption, restoration. God's, what is on offer is God saying to you, there's no condemnation anymore. You're forgiven because Jesus took your condemnation. That's what's available to us in Jesus. That's what many of us have accepted. That's what many of us celebrate, not just at Easter, but every week, every day. That's what we have. The incredible solution that Jesus brings, forgiveness. And the second level, forgiveness and transformation as well. At that very same moment that a person comes to put their trust in Jesus and is forgiven, that is the moment where transformation begins. Because it's the moment where a person is given a new heart, a heart transplant, which is what we need, isn't it? Because if this heart really is as corrupt and evil and wicked as Jesus is saying that it is, then any kind of tweaking or coaching is not going to do it. We need a new one. And that's what the Bible says. It says, oh, I've got a new heart for you. You know, Jesus kind of speaks about this new birth, a new spiritual birth, you know, in John chapter 3, when he's speaking to Nicodemus. And Jesus says, look, I'll come and live by my spirit in you and give you new birth in that moment. Ezekiel chapter 36, God promises this new heart that's available. Let me read that to you, Ezekiel 36. God promises this, and it comes to us through Jesus, and it's this, I'll give you a new heart. I will put a new spirit in you. I will remove from you your heart of stone. Thank you very much. You can take that away. A stone cold heart towards God that's evil and wicked. Please take that from me. And he says, and I'll give you a heart of flesh, a heart that's soft and warm towards God, a heart that actually wants to honor God and love God. I'll take that. That's what's available. He says, I will put my spirit in you. I will move you to follow my decrees and be careful to keep my laws. Friends, this moment where you get a new heart from God is the moment where transformation begins. It's not the moment where you become perfected. Now, that moment is still coming for us. It's in the future. Your perfection will be completed on the final day. But the moment you receive this new heart, where the Spirit of Christ moves in and sets up camp in you, is the moment where transformation begins. And it's the moment where true hope starts to, you know, there's hope for change, real change now. If you've got a new heart, there's hope now for new thoughts and new desires. And new dreams and hopes that are actually focused on loving God and honoring God and giving ourselves to why God has created us in the first place. Transformation, new birth. If you've come to put your trust in Jesus, this is what he's doing in you now. And so my encouragement would be just be aware of the transformation that God intends to bring now as he's living in you and giving you a new heart. You cooperate with the Lord as he seeks to change you. You walk in step with the Spirit as he seeks to transform you. That's his intention for you now. Changing you continually. We're all a work of progress, but being changed as we look forward to the day where we are perfected in glory. Yeah, what wonderful news. What wonderful news. There's real hope in Jesus. Solid hope. There's a solution, a real solution in Jesus. And if you've taken that solution and put your trust in it, you celebrate him, you rejoice in him, keep giving yourself to walking with him. And for those of you here this morning, still considering these things, I don't know, maybe you've caught a glimpse, or maybe you've heard for the very first time even, what the real problem is. This is hard to hear, even harder to accept. But if you never catch it, you'll miss out on the real solution. Don't do that. Consider this, be sobered by this reality that Jesus brings to us, and you go hunting, looking into Jesus. Friends, that is where the real solution, the only real solution to a corrupted heart can be found. Let me pray. Father, thank you for your word to us, though it's hard to hear and unflattering to consider. To hear that we are corrupted in the very core of our beings is so hard to hear, but it's possible to hear when we know that you've come for us with a solution that's real and comprehensive. Thank you for sending Jesus. Thank you that we have available to us forgiveness and transformation. Lord, we ask that it would be many more who receive this forgiveness and transformation. We ask that you would be working by your Spirit in us in such a way that it would be evident of your power and strength would be evident and your name would be glorified. Amen.